Chapter 6. Assassination. It was October in the year 1092, and the Grand Vizier of Turkey, Nizam al-Mulk, was holding an audience in his tent. Guards armed with scimitars surrounded him, for he was one of the most powerful men in the Middle East, and many people wished him dead. The audience came to an end. Nizam climbed into his litter and signalled the slaves to carry him out. At the door, a half-naked holy man, a Sufi, came forward to kiss Nizam's hand. The guards stood aside to allow him to approach. Suddenly, the holy man drew a knife from his trousers and stabbed Nizam to the heart. The guards leapt forward, and within seconds the holy man had been cut to pieces, but he had carried out his instructions. Instructions that came from his chief, known as the Old Man of the Mountain. And Nizam al-Mulk had just become the first victim of the assassins. The real name of the Old Man of the Mountain was Hasan ibn al-Saba. He lived in an impregnable fortress high in the Elburz Mountains of Persia, and had the frightening distinction of having invented the art of political assassination. He was also the head of the sect called the Ismailis, the Muslim equivalent of Protestants. His followers believed he could guarantee them an eternity in paradise. The traveller Marco Polo has a strange story to tell about the fortress of the assassins, which was known as Alamut, Eagle's Nest. Polo claimed that the Old Man of the Mountain had a beautiful garden laid in the green valley behind the castle. He filled it with fruit trees, fountains and pavilions. When the old man wanted an enemy murdered, he would ask for volunteers. The men who stepped forward would be given drugged wine. When they woke up, they would find themselves in paradise. Beautiful girls, or huris, were there to attend to all their needs. After a few days of sensual delight, they were again drugged and taken back to the fortress. The old man would tell them that he had allowed them a glimpse of the paradise that would be theirs forever if they died for him. This, said Polo, was why there was no shortage of volunteers. They were so eager to die and to become part of the life eternal that the old man would sometimes order them to jump out of high windows just to impress visitors. Hasan ibn al-Saba's aim was power, to make himself master of the Muslim world and its religious leader. If he was to achieve this, he had to conquer the Turks, who ruled most of the Middle East and who supported the Orthodox Muslims. But how could a religious leader, with only a few hundred followers, conquer a great nation? Hasan had his answer. Murder. Carefully planned political murder. He reasoned that the best way to win a war is to slay your enemy's leader. To begin with, his plan succeeded brilliantly. Nizam al-Mulk's son, Fakhri, swore revenge. One day, in the streets of Naishapur, he was accosted by an old beggar who moaned, "The true Muslims are no more, and there is none left to take the hand of the afflicted." Touched, Fakhri reached into his robe for money and was stabbed to the heart. Enraged, Nizam's other son, Ahmed, set out to avenge his father and his brother. His army besieged the castle of the old man, and discovered to its cost that it was impregnable. Not long after he had abandoned the siege, Ahmed was also stabbed by an assassin. He was luckier than his father and his brother, and eventually recovered from the wound. Another sheikh who set out to fight the old man woke up one morning to find a knife embedded in the ground near his pillow and a note. "This knife could just as easily have been in your heart." That convinced him. He made a truce with the old man instead. Oddly enough, it was Hasan's very efficiency in the art of murder that finally defeated him. When people thought of the Old Man of the Mountain, they shuddered. He seemed like a poisonous black spider brooding in his mountain retreat. A really successful leader needs friends and allies. Hasan ibn al-Saba mainly inspired horror. When he died, still in his lair at the age of 90, he was an embittered old man who had achieved none of his great ambitions. The Order of Assassins survived his death for another 100 years, and there were more Old Men of the Mountain. But their day was over, and they were finally stamped out by their enemies. The breakaway sect, called the Ismailis, still exists today. Its leader is called the Aga Khan, and in sporting circles he's perhaps better known as the owner of racehorses. Although the assassins disappeared, there is a curious possibility, which has never been investigated by historians, that they may only have moved elsewhere. When the British became masters of India in the mid-18th century, they noticed that the roads were infested with brigands and that hundreds of people disappeared each year. At the time, they didn't attach much significance to this fact. Then, in 1812, a young British doctor named Robert Sherwood, stationed with the army in Madras, suddenly entertained a horrible suspicion that all the disappearances were not just casual murders by bandits, but were carefully planned religious sacrifices. He questioned some of the robbers who had been caught and induced them to talk to him frankly. They admitted that they belonged to a sect called the Tugs, and that for 1 month a year they took to the roads and murdered countless travellers. Their method was almost foolproof. Looking like harmless travellers, sometimes religious pilgrims, they would find a party of wayfarers and ask if they could join them. As the days went by, more Tugs would join the band, until Tugs outnumbered the genuine travellers. At a given signal, a Tug would attack each traveller from behind, throwing a strangling noose around his neck, while another Tug tripped him and held him down. When all the travellers were dead, they would be tossed into a mass grave, their bodies mutilated to aid decomposition. The Tugs would then hold a religious ceremony near the grave, offering the dead as sacrifices to their god Kali, the goddess of destruction and creation, and keeping their victims' money and valuables for themselves. The British were horrified by these revelations. This was carrying a religion too far. William Sleeman was appointed to stamp out Tuggy, and he succeeded so well that by 1850 more than 4,000 Tugs had been tried and most of them executed. Some betrayed other Tugs in exchange for their lives. The Tugs were one of the biggest murder organisations in history. There was nothing like it until Hitler's death camps. Sleeman reckoned that they had committed over 1 million murders in the 19th century alone. But the mystery remains. Who were they? And where did they come from? There are a few clues. When the assassins fled from the Middle East towards the end of the 13th century, one of the countries they went to was India. India still has an enormous number of Ismailis, although it should be noted that the assassins were only one single branch of the Ismailis. Sleeman was puzzled that the Tugs worshipped the goddess Kali, a Hindu goddess, for they were not Hindus but Muslims. One captured Tug told Sleeman that Kali was another name for Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad. And Fatima was the head of a breakaway sect that later became the Ismailis. Altogether, it seems possible that the Tugs were the descendants of the assassins of the Old Man of the Mountain. The word assassin was derived from hashishim, a taker of hashish or pot. This was how the Europeans explained to themselves the frightening self-sacrifice of Hassan's Ismailis. Gradually, the word passed into most languages. In France, assassin simply means a murderer. In Europe, assassination lost its religious overtones and became purely political. But since most Europeans lacked the fanatical temperament, it remained relatively rare. Two notable assassinations were those of Henri III of France, who was stabbed to death in 1589 by a Dominican friar who disliked the king's Protestant sympathies, and the French king Henri IV, murdered in 1610 by a Catholic fanatic who thought he intended to make war on the Pope. Then came the Age of Reason. Religious fervour cooled. There were still occasional attempts on the lives of kings and leading statesmen, but they were usually made by cranks or by men with an insane grudge. In 1757, an idiot called Robert-François Damien made a half-hearted attempt to murder Louis XV of France with a blunt knife and was horribly executed, torn into four quarters while still alive by four horses. But less than a century later, the world had become more humane. When a lunatic named Daniel McNaghten shot and killed the secretary of the Prime Minister of England, he was recognised as insane and confined to an asylum. That was in 1843, and the result was the famous McNaghten Rules, which saved many murderers from the gallows. Yet, strangely enough, the great second age of assassination was now about to begin. It was signalled by the shot that rang out in a box at Ford's Theatre in Washington on the evening of April the 14th, 1865. Abraham Lincoln fell forward, shot in the back of the head. His assassin, John Wilkes Booth, leapt onto the stage, but he was wearing spurs, and one of them caught in the curtain. He fell 14 feet, breaking his shin. It was the beginning of the bad luck that lasted until he was killed 12 days later in a barn in Virginia. The sergeant who shot him said he had orders from the Almighty. In December 1870, as Juan Prim, the Prime Minister of Spain, was leaving the government chamber in Madrid, he was shot down by an unknown assassin. Prim was a liberal who was hated by the reactionary right-wingers. The murderer was never caught, one of the very few assassinations in which the killer has escaped. But in the rest of Europe, it was not the liberals who were becoming the target for assassins, it was the establishment, the very notion of law and order. The ideas of socialists such as the French social reformer Charles Fourier, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon and the German Karl Marx had taken root. Men like Prince Peter Kropotkin and Enrico Malatesta were preaching an even more sinister doctrine called anarchism, the belief that all men are naturally good and that if only we could get rid of all authority, society would become a kind of Garden of Eden. The strange thing was that these kindly idealists should become identified with slaughter and violence. The politician and economist Proudhon invented the word anarchy, meaning no government. He would have been amazed if someone had told him that it would soon arouse as much horror as the word assassin had 8 centuries earlier. The thunder of anarchist bombs began in 1879. The Tsar of Russia, Alexander II, had survived several attempts on his life by bullets. On one occasion, the pistol blew up and shattered the would-be assassin's arm. Then a terrorist called Zhelyabov swore that he would blow the Tsar sky-high. He planted an immense charge of nitroglycerine on a railway line so that the explosion would blast the Tsar's train into a ravine. It was a spectacular idea, but it failed when a passing cart cut the wire. His next attempt, though, was successful, but the Tsar wasn't on the train. In February 1880, anarchists succeeded in planting a charge of dynamite in the dining room chimney of the Tsar's winter palace, timed to go off as he ate his supper. A guest was late, and the Tsar delayed going into the room, which was demolished by the blast. But Alexander's luck was running out. On March 1, 1881, he had been inspecting his troops and was returning by carriage. Anarchists with homemade bombs, nitroglycerine in glass balls, were stationed along several possible routes in St. Petersburg. The Tsar may have been feeling slightly more secure than usual because Zhelyabov had been arrested the day before. Suddenly, there was an explosion behind the carriage, shattering its door and wounding a Cossack and a boy. The Tsar made the mistake of getting out to offer his sympathies. Another anarchist threw a bomb, and this time the blast killed the assassin and 20 bystanders and smashed windows for 180 yards. The Tsar's legs were mangled, and he died a few hours later in his palace, surrounded by his weeping family. The murder triggered a violent wave of reprisals against all known leftists. Political repression came down like a shutter of lead. In 1887, a student leader named Alexander Ulyanov was hanged with 4 fellow students for an unsuccessful attempt on the life of Alexander III. His younger brother, Vladimir, vowed to avenge the death, and 30 years later he did so. By then he had changed his name to Lenin. Now the anarchists were inspired by an ideal that amounted to a religion, and for the next quarter of a century the bombs exploded and the blood flowed. On May Day 1892, a workers' demonstration led by anarchists was broken up by mounted police in the Paris suburb of Clichy. 5 anarchists were brutally beaten by the police. At their trial, an indignant prosecutor demanded the death penalty. But no one was now that angry or bitter. 1 defendant was acquitted, the other 2 given 3- and 5-year sentences, respectively. 6 months later, the home of the judge, Monsieur Benoist, was destroyed by a bomb. And 2 weeks after that, another bomb destroyed the home of the prosecutor who had demanded the death penalty. The police wanted to interview a young man with a scar on his hand. A café waiter named Leroux noticed such a mark on the hand of a voluble young customer and called the police. It took 10 men to subdue the man, who called himself Ravachol. He proudly admitted the bombings, saying that his aim had been to avenge the Clichy anarchists. For a while he was an anarchist hero, until the police discovered that he had committed several murders in the course of robbery. The police declared that he was a common criminal, and the anarchists were inclined to agree. Just before his trial opened, another bomb exploded in the restaurant where he had been arrested, killing the proprietor. When the trial opened, the Palais de Justice was surrounded by troops, anticipating more anarchist outrages. Ravachol was sentenced to death, so inciting further violence. "I know I shall be revenged," he said, and died shouting, "Long live anarchy!" 4 months later, a bomb was planted in the Paris office of a mining company who were engaged in a struggle with strikers. It was discovered, and a policeman carried it off to his police station, where it exploded, killing 6 men. In March 1893, a workman named Auguste Vaillant, who whose family was starving, manufactured a bomb out of a saucepan, gunpowder and nails, and hurled it in the Chamber of Deputies. It was intended to be a protest, not to kill anyone. Only a few deputies were scratched with nails, but the government was now thoroughly alarmed, and Vaillant was speedily executed. The anarchist cause had another martyr. A week later, a bomb exploded in a boulevard café, killing one man and wounding 20, and bombs went off in other parts of Paris. 4 explosions in a few weeks. One of them killed the anarchist who was carrying the bomb, and he proved to be responsible for 2 of the explosions. In another explosion, a writer named Laurent Taillard lost an eye. He had made headlines some time before when asked his opinion of the Vaillant explosion. He had replied grandly, "What do the victims matter if it's a fine gesture?" Now he knew. An anarchist named Émile Henry was arrested for the café explosion and explained proudly that he had intended to kill as many of the bourgeoisie, in other words the middle-class citizens who could afford to drink in the cafés, as possible. Henry was executed in May of 1874, and the following month, as President Sadi Carnot was driving through Lyon in his carriage, a young man stepped forward holding a bunch of flowers. The police let him approach. He drew a knife and stabbed Sadi Carnot to the heart. The day after the murder of Sadi Carnot, his widow received a letter posted before the attack containing a photograph of Ravachol with the words, "He is avenged." France was not the only country that resounded to the crash of anarchist bombs and pistols. In May 1885, police charged into Haymarket Square in Chicago to break up a demonstration of strikers. Some hurled a bomb into the police ranks, killing 7 officers. As a result of this, 8 anarchists were arrested arbitrarily and sentenced to death. 1 managed to blow himself up on the night before his execution. 3 were pardoned. The other 4 were hanged. With so many people dying in want or slaving for starvation wages, the United States was ideal soil for anarchist movements. In June 1892, there was a strike of steelworkers at Homestead, Pennsylvania, when strikers attacked and killed blacklegs, and the governor sent in the militia to repress them. A young Russian anarchist named Alexander Berkman managed to bluff his way into the office of the steelworks. There he drew a pistol and shot the manager, Henry Clay Frick, twice, and then stabbed him 7 times. Miraculously, Frick survived. Berkman was sentenced to 16 years in jail, and the United States broke into an uproar of condemnation or support for Berkman. As propaganda for anarchism, Berkman's act was totally successful. 8 years later, in 1900, an Italian-American weaver called Gaetano Breschi sailed from Paterson, New Jersey, intending to assassinate King Humbert I of Italy. He succeeded on July the 29th, shooting the king as he was distributing prizes at Monza near Milan. In the United States, a Polish-American named Leon Czolgosz was fascinated by the newspaper account of the killing and decided to earn himself a similar fame. Since Lincoln's death, another American president had fallen to the hands of a killer. In 1881, President Garfield had been shot by a vain little coxcomb of a man, Charles Guiteau, who was suffering from delusions. Guiteau was executed, having gained the notoriety he craved. Czolgosz also bought a revolver, and on September 6, 1901, joined a queue of people waiting to shake hands with President William McKinley, who was visiting the Pan-American Exposition in Buffalo. As the president held out his hand, Czolgosz shot him in the chest and abdomen. At his trial, Czolgosz refused to speak to anyone. He was the first assassin to die by electrocution. After his death, sulfuric acid was poured into his coffin to destroy the body. In Russia, the bombs and pistols continued to explode, killing government ministers, chiefs of police, even the Prime Minister Stolypin. In Serbia, King Alexander I and Queen Draga were slaughtered in their palace in Belgrade by army officers on June 10, 1903. And on February 1, 1908, the unpopular King Carlos I of Portugal was shot down, together with his son, Crown Prince Luis, in the corner of the Praça in Lisbon by revolutionaries. But the shot that put an end to revolutionary slaughter exploded on Sunday, June 28, 1914. It killed Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria as he drove in his carriage in Sarajevo in Serbia. It was fired by Gavrilo Princip. A second shot killed the Archduchess. In a sense, Princip achieved more than any other revolutionary. His 2 shots brought about World War I and the Russian Revolution of 1917. After more than a quarter of a century of bullets, bombs and blood, the anarchists had achieved their aim and the second great age of assassination was over.